From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Washington Post columnist Mark Thiessen once worked for North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. Thiessen says he believes Helms would appreciate much of what Donald Trump is doing in the White House. You'll learn why. In the middle of a state budget impasse, North Carolina lawmakers nonetheless voted to approve budget items linked to hurricane disaster relief. You'll hear part of their debate. You'll learn why some lawmakers question whether state government is setting aside enough money for the next disaster. North Carolina ranks number 18 in the country in freedom, according to a recent report. You'll hear the good, the bad, and the ugly about state government policies and their impact on freedom. What does North Carolina do well? What should it do better? What should it not do at all? Plus, we'll review new data about the North Carolina lottery. It still relies on low-income players from low-income counties. That's been consistent throughout the state lottery's nearly 15-year history. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
This month, our country celebrated Constitution Day in honor of the day 232 years ago that delegates to the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia signed our founding document. In fact, three North Carolinians actually signed the Constitution. Now, over the years, progressives have attempted to use a theory of law designed to undermine the Constitution's power. And our next guest says that we really can't afford to be complacent about this even today. John Guzet has written a really fascinating piece that you can read at johnlock.org. He's the director of legal studies and joins me now. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Can you talk first about kind of the thinking behind the foundational document and what people were thinking in that time about what they were trying to prevent in terms of government power and what people today might refer to as totalitarianism?
Well, in those days, they would have used the term absolutism instead. But what they were responding to and trying to move beyond was the concept of absolute power in the hands of some kind of monarch or divine ruler. This was an important issue at the time. And really, the Enlightenment, one of the great things about the Enlightenment was the realization that it's not so much important to put the right person in power, whether ordained by God or otherwise. What's important is to restrict the power of government so that whoever happens to find themselves in power can't do too much damage.
That's an interesting concept because today, in political terms at least, we talk about handing power to a person or a group of people. But really, the thinking was the opposite.
It was, but this seems to be something that's cyclical. We go through cycles where we suffer from too much government power, as people did in the 17th century, and there was a reaction in the 18th when people realized it was important to provide limitations. The same thing happened in the 20th century. This time around, it was called totalitarianism, but we had absolute rulers all over Europe who did just incredible damage. And so by the end of the 20th century, some of us at least realized we have to get back to the idea of a limited government with constitutional checks and balances.
Before we talk a little bit more about the whole progressive view and what's happening today, John, could you kind of remind us of why there was such a debate over adding a Bill of Rights to the Constitution?
Well, even though the delegates who assembled in Philadelphia, probably to a man, they realized that it was important to limit the power of government, and they provided a lot of features in the Constitution itself that did just that. When it went out to be ratified by the states, there was still a lot of concern that it didn't go far enough to limit the power of the new government that was going to be created. So when it was ultimately ratified, it was done on the understanding that one of the first acts that the new Congress would do once it was in power was provide amendments to further restrict the power of government. That's how those amendments came to be known as the Bill of Rights, and that's why they happened, because everybody at every level in the late 18th century in the United States understood it was important to limit the power of government.
And yet, in this really fascinating piece that you have written about this, you say by the late 1890s, there was already a push by some to try to kind of get around the limits on power.
Absolutely. It's very interesting. If you go back and you look at some of the speeches that people like Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt were giving early in the 20th century, they were running against the Constitution. They were stating explicitly that what we needed was more government power and that it was a shame we were stuck with this obsolete document that provided all these arcane limits that made no sense in the beginning of the 20th century.
Was that really the beginning, John, then, of what a lot of people refer to today as the theory of the living document versus textualism or constitutionalism, things
Absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely. In fact, in one of the speeches he gave in that election campaign, Woodrow Wilson used the term living document. That's where we got the idea that the Constitution has to change with the times, no matter what the intention was of the people who wrote it, no matter what the words of the document actually say.
Give us a sense then of, since that time of Wilson and Roosevelt, how has this manifested itself, this idea that we're going to push back against limits on people and branches of government?
Well, these progressives, including both of those gentlemen, very much thought that it was important to put some technocrats in charge of everything, not just the economy, although they felt that strongly, but the personal people's personal lives as well. So they wanted things like prohibition, which they ultimately got. They wanted things like a program of aggressive eugenics that would remake humanity along more rational lines. And they got that too. But the process of doing that was difficult. Eventually, under immense pressure from the Franklin Roosevelt administration in the 1930s, the Supreme Court finally threw in the towel and said, we're going to stop trying to enforce the letter of the Constitution when it comes to people's rights and legislation that seems to abuse those rights. Instead, we're going to just assume that any legislation that comes before us is constitutional unless it's there. We can find absolutely no rational basis for it.
And what's your reaction to that?
Well, on the one hand, it's a shame. I mean, we had these provisions in the Constitution for a reason, and it's very important to limit government. And the very fact that prohibition was such a disaster and that involuntary sterilization was an even worse disaster in this country, it ought to be proof enough that we need those restrictions. On the other hand, though, things could have been worse in Europe where at the beginning of the 20th century, many of those countries had constitutions similar to ours. In fact, some of them were based on ours, but all that was swept away completely in the 1930s. They ended up with real absolute dictators, and things were even worse there, much, much worse there. So I think what the positive way to look at what happened here in the 1930s was it was a compromise. It was a balance of power between the progressives on the one hand, constitutionalists on the other. And because we kept the Constitution as our formal law of the land, it made it possible for certain things to happen. Some rights continued to be enforced, like the right to freedom of speech, even after this compromise. That's because in those days, unlike now, progressives were perfectly willing for people to have freedom of speech. They hadn't decided that was one of the rights they wanted to get rid of. But it also made it possible for there to be what I call a constitutional revival. And that's what we've seen ever since Antonin Scalia was appointed to the court, and it's continued to accelerate. I think there's a good chance that the 21st century will see more rather than less constitutional protections.
That's really interesting because we have a very public and I would say very powerful push by people on the left side of the ideological spectrum who very much believe in this living document theory of the Constitution. Yet it sounds like you are actually hopeful.
Well, you're certainly right about people. The today's progressives, today's philosopher kings would like to get rid of the Constitution. They want absolute power. But Karl Popper, my hero of a philosopher, used to say that institutions are like fortresses. They have to be well designed and well manned. Right now, I think our Supreme Court and some of our other federal courts are pretty well manned. And as long as they continue to be that way, I think the Constitution still has a bright future.
You mentioned the issue of free speech. And is that the biggest concern for you, John, as you see it, the attempted erosion of constitutional rights?
No, it's just one of many. There's all kinds of provisions in the Constitution that the progressives want to tear down. The Second Amendment is another. And more generally, they simply want more federal power and more state power, for that matter, than the Constitution permits and that I think would be advisable.
John Guzet is the director of legal studies for the John Locke Foundation, and he's written this piece that is a great read. I would encourage all of you to go to the John Locke Foundation website. That is johnlocke.org. Also, carolinajournal.com, and you can find it there. The Constitution and Its Enemies. Great analysis of where we have come from and where we are today. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Before Mark Thiessen started writing for the Washington Post, he served as chief speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Earlier in his career, Thiessen worked for North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. Thiessen recalls one of his earliest memories of Helms.
I went down and I knocked on the senator's door and I said, Senator, and he said, yeah, come in, son. And I said, did you see what the New York Times wrote about you today? And he said, nope. And I said, well, I've written this letter to the editor. Would you take a look at it? And so he smiled and he took it in his hand and he looked at it and he marked it up a little bit. And he said, okay, you go ahead and you send it off. And I was walking out of the door really proud of myself on my first day on the job. And he stopped me and he said, son, just so you understand, I don't care what the New York Times says about me, and nobody I care about cares what the New York Times says about me. And I did send off the letter, and I would call the New York Times and call them out when they said bad things about Jesse Helms. But Jesse Helms was probably the only politician in Washington who literally did not care what the New York Times said about him. Meet the Press, the big show was Tim Russert, Meet the Press back then. Every press secretary in Capitol Hill was trying to get their boss on Meet the Press. Tim Russert called me once a month, and my job was to tell him, no, Senator Helms doesn't want to be on Meet the Press. Because he just didn't care. And so that was why he was able to do so many of the things that he was able to do and withstand all the pressure, because he literally, they were powerless against him because he literally didn't care what they thought. He knew his convictions. He knew what he thought was right. He hired a lot of smart people, smarter than me, experts in different areas of foreign policy, and gave them their marching orders and empowered us. And so we loved working for him because he would never cut your feet out from under you. He would always stand by his. If he made a decision, if he said we're going to hold the line here, that's where the line was going to be held.
So what did Jesse Helms accomplish, not caring what the New York Times thought?
He did an enormous amount. I mean, look, Helms was the man who brought the first round of NATO expansion, bringing former Warsaw Pact countries into the NATO alliance, Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. And they turned out to be some of the best allies the United States had after September 11, 2001. They were the first ones to offer up troops when all the Europeans were ringing their old Europe, as Don Rumsfeld called it, was wringing its hands. New Europe, those countries were saying, tell us where to send our troops. We're with you. That was, I think, visionary. He reformed the United Nations. He got them to reduce the bureaucracy by over 1,000 people and cut the U.S. arrears. And he became the first senator in American history ever to address the U.N. Security Council. He reformed the State Department. Ronald Reagan used to say there's nothing so near eternal life as a temporary government agency. Well, Helms shut down two government agencies, which was unprecedented at the time, the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and the U.S. Information Agency, and reformed the State Department. And he killed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. He stopped the Clinton administration from negotiating a new ABM treaty, which would have prevented us from having ballistic missile defenses. Can you imagine with North Korea now on the verge of having a missile that can hit the United States if we didn't have any kind of missile defense? So Helms was a vision visionary there. He stopped us from joining the International Criminal Court. So he accomplished a lot of things, and he stopped a lot of bad things from happening as well.
Would Helms have accomplished any of these things if he had paid attention to the Washington establishment?
Oh, no. I mean, how can you be against the International Criminal Court? I mean, they just want to try dictators who commit genocide. Are you for genocide? No. What he objected to was the idea that the UN, that the International Criminal Court could try American soldiers and American public servants for carrying out American foreign policy. And he didn't want to submit them to a United Nations International Criminal Court. And he's been proven right on that. The ABM Treaty, well, oh my gosh, there's going to be an arms race with Russia if we pull out of the ABM Treaty. Well, George W. Bush ended up pulling out of the ABM Treaty, and guess what? There was no arms race. We had historic reductions in nuclear weapons. So, you know, what he used to call the striped pants crowd likes to set its hair on fire a lot, and he didn't care what the striped pants crowd had to say.
That's the voice of Mark Thiessen, Washington Post columnist, former chief speechwriter for George W. Bush, and former press secretary for North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. What would Helms think about President Trump?
Donald Trump was elected because he was fighting for the forgotten Americans who both the establishments of both political parties had overlooked and were ignoring, and they wanted to get their voices heard. Jesse Helms was fighting for the forgotten Americans long before Donald Trump even thought about running for office. I mean, you know, he was fighting for the people. I remember he had telling us a story on one of his campaigns where he had been out in eastern North Carolina, and he had said something that caused like the media to swarm down on a rally he was having at a farm somewhere, and he said, "If you want to know who the reporters are, they're the ones with shoes on." You know, I mean, he was fighting for the forgotten Americans who were overlooked by the political elites in Washington long before Donald Trump came along. And so he'd be very proud of the fact that President Trump is fighting for those people. In the Republican Party, the orthodoxy was free trade. We had more free trade agreements and all the rest of it. And Helms was the one saying, well, what about manufacturing workers here in North Carolina who are losing their jobs because of these bad trade agreements? And now Donald Trump has renegotiated NAFTA. He's cracking down on China. Jesse Helms was the lonely voice in the Senate fighting against China getting most favored nation status and entry in the WTO. It's turned out to be a disaster. China is an economic predator that is stealing our intellectual property and forcing American businesses to hand over proprietary information and closing its markets off to us in dozens of sectors. And so Trump is pushing back and saying, no, we're going to put tariffs on you unless you open up your markets to American manufacturing goods. And Trump and Jesse Helms would be cheering for him because he was saying it 20 years ago. So there's so many areas. And then, you know, there's other areas of foreign policy that I think he would be very happy with. He would be thrilled that Donald Trump is cracking down on the socialist dictatorship in Venezuela the way he has and supporting the Democratic opposition. He'd be thrilled that he was reversing Obama's disastrous opening to Cuba and the Castro regime over there. He'd be thrilled that we're cracking down on the International Criminal Court, and because the International Criminal Court, which Helms predicted, is opening an investigation into U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. So they kept saying, we're never going to prosecute Americans. We're not interested. We just want to go after the dictators. They want to start investigating us for war crimes. And Jesse Helms warned about it, and Donald Trump has basically declared war on the International Criminal Court, saying you're not going to get to do that. So there's so many areas where Jesse Helms would be enormously pleased with the way things are going on foreign policy.
Would Jesse Helms give Donald Trump advice?
The most important piece of advice is to set clear goals and empower your people and give them the freedom to act in your name. Jesse Helms and Bud Nance put together an amazing team of people and gave them the freedom to carry out their orders and backed them to the hilt when they did it. So, I mean, that's the most important piece of advice. And the other thing that's really important is not so much for Trump and his team, but just generally for people in Washington. So Bud Nance was an incredibly – this is a guy who – he was a Navy test pilot with Alan Shepard and John Glenn. You know, he was doing rocket sleds in the Mojave Desert in some of the he was in one unit, half the unit died in crashes. He was a pilot. He was a sailor after graduating from the Naval Academy on the USS North Carolina, survived 162 kamikaze attacks. I mean, he's skipper of the USS Forrestal, one of the great aircraft carriers during the Cold War. So he had a lot to be proud of in his career. he was not at all concerned with titles, not at all concerned with riches. He used to, you know, when people would come into Bud's office and they'd say they wanted a new title, we worked in a place called the Dirksen Senate Office Building, and he'd say to us, if you want to put on your business card, you can go ahead and call yourself the Duke of Dirksen for all I care. He said that, and he would always tell us that a man brings honor on the title, a title does not bring honor on the man. And I think that's an important lesson as well.
You referenced Bud Nance, the retired admiral who ran Jesse Helms' foreign policy operation, also the namesake of a new lecture series from the Jesse Helms Center. The first lecturer, our guest, Mark Thiessen. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During an ongoing state budget impasse, North Carolina lawmakers nonetheless agreed to move forward with the piece of the budget addressing disaster relief. One section targeted hurricane recovery. Republican Representative Chuck McGrady.
In light of Hurricane Dorian, a range of our coastal legislators, I'm sure, want to make sure that, you know, there's going to be money available for Dorian-related disaster relief or others. The only piece of this bill, the primary piece of this bill that relates to future, is in Section 1.4. And you'll see, again, we're putting money in a pot that the administration can pull down for future disasters. I will say my expectation, based on talking to colleagues and leadership, is that there will be another disaster relief bill at some point in the future. So if those of you on the coast who have dealt with Dorian have specific issues that are going to come up, it's just way too early to assess the damages that have occurred. In Matthew, for example, we went very quickly, more quickly than I've ever seen. That occurred in October when we passed the bill in December, and we still weren't ready. So a week after a hurricane, we're not going to be there either.
Democratic State Representative Zach Hawkins asked McGrady about the money set aside for future disasters.
There's $5 million for future events. Do you think, given that we've had multiple 100-year storms, do you think that's enough for North Carolina moving forward?
That's not a number that I know. You know, there are some years we wouldn't use that much money, and there are other years we far exceeded it. We traditionally in the budget, though, put money in to allow the administration to have money to spend on projects that just, you know, suddenly come up.
North Carolina Emergency Management Director Mike Sprayberry offered his assessment of the budget funding for future disasters.
$5 million is a place marker. It's very difficult to determine what's going to be needed in the future. We currently have just experienced another hurricane. We have more brewing out in the Atlantic. So I think that's my guess is that we'll probably be coming back to the General Assembly to ask for more funding in the future. But $5 million will give us an estimated amount so that we can take care of things right now. It's pretty difficult to really come up with a very, very granular estimate on what we're needing for the future.
You've been listening to Debate About Disaster Relief in the North Carolina State Budget. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina ranks number 18 among the states when it comes to freedom. That's according to a report prepared for the Libertarian Cato Institute. One of the report's authors, Jason Sorens, recently shared details in Winston-Salem. He was speaking to the group Classical Liberals in the Carolinas. Sorens started by answering a basic question.
Why measure freedom? I think there's a social science purpose. We want to look at some of the causes and consequences of freedom. We want to see whether this has impacts on growth and things like that. It's also a tool for citizens and journalists to hold politicians accountable, and a useful tool of comparison for businesses that are figuring out where to invest or people who are figuring out where to live.
Sorens has assessed the good, the bad, and the ugly of North Carolina policies when it comes to freedom.
So what is North Carolina doing well? Well, one area it has done well is actually trimming repeatedly income taxes. So it's gone from a pretty high tax state, especially in income taxes, to a sort of average state when we come to income taxes in particular. And we're going to see further improvement in the next edition of the index, because there's been some further cuts in 2017. Government debt, consumption, and employment have also fallen, and so North Carolina is gradually improving on fiscal policy. Affordable housing is not generally a big problem in North Carolina. Zoning rules by national standards have been pretty relaxed, which has allowed a lot of people to move into the state. Affordable housing helps with that. No minimum wage, right to work, relaxed workers' comp rules, the labor market regime. It's also fairly pro-employment. has had cable and telecom deregulation. We estimate that's benefited North Carolinians about $200 million annually, so a non-trivial sum. The civil liability system has improved over time. This is something a lot of southern states have sort of struggled with kind of absurd tort awards, especially against out-of-state defendants, and that has now improved. There's no state-level civil asset forfeiture. It's one of two states that do not have any civil asset forfeiture at all. There's criminal asset forfeiture, but it has to go through the criminal court system. Actually, crime-adjusted incarceration and victimless crime arrest rates are below average. So unlike most southern states, this is one where the criminal justice regime has been had a fairly light hand compared to some other states. And school choice has been gradually expanded. There are some other states that are still doing a little better here, but there was some further improvement since the closing date of our last edition, and so in the forthcoming sixth edition, you'll see North Carolina improve further on educational freedom.
That's the voice of Jason Sorens, an author of the Freedom in the 50 States report for the Libertarian Cato Institute. He told us what's good about North Carolina policy. That leaves the bad and the ugly.
We'll start with the bad, the stuff where North Carolina could certainly do better. Eminent domain abuse has never been curbed, at least not significantly, unlike South Carolina as a state that never took action here, significant action. There was an e-verify mandate enacted in 2011. This is a labor market regulation a lot of conservative states have enacted as part of their kind of anti-immigration push. Nurse practitioner and dental hygienist practice freedom is highly restricted. Again, something for whatever reason we see in a lot of southern states. They tend to be very attentive to the physicians' lobby and their desire to keep nurse practitioners from practicing independently. While the state doesn't have civil asset forfeiture, the federal government does, and so what we've seen is that local law enforcement agencies in North Carolina are very willing to turn cases over to the Department of Justice to get a share of the spoils from forfeiting properties under the very relaxed federal rules. Gun laws are kind of mediocre here. If you're a gun person, you'll know this. That's been the case for a long time. State liquor stores, which you all know, pretty high markups. We have state liquor stores in New Hampshire, but essentially very, very low markup, essentially zero taxation. So if you ever want to stock up on Hennessy, there was a case recently where a New Yorker was smuggling Hennessy from New Hampshire to New York, and they went to jail in New York for that. we don't have any medical marijuana here in North Carolina, no surprise, perhaps.
Sorens didn't stop with the bad North Carolina policies that limit freedom.
What about the ugly, the stuff that New North Carolina should really, really be improving? Well, managed care regulations were a big thing in the early 2000s, and you don't hear them talked about much recently, but economists have studied this and found that by essentially prohibiting the classic HMO model, some states have driven up health care costs. So by mandating that insurers provide standing referrals, they can't require you to go back and get additional referrals for specialist care, by mandating direct access to specialists, by prohibiting insurers from giving physicians financial incentives for limiting care, right? None of this stuff is popular, right? But there is evidence that in the late 90s and early 2000s, when these things were in place, they did actually limit overutilization of the healthcare system. Strict auto and homeowners insurance price controls. You might not notice this if you're a good driver, because insurers are willing to insure you. But if you've had an accident or two, it's very difficult to get insured in North Carolina. Because of the price controls.
That's not all that's ugly about North Carolina policies.
There's actually a minimum markup law for gasoline. So gas stations are not allowed to charge you too little. But there's also an anti-price gouging law. So if there's a disaster, they're not allowed to charge you too much either. If you want to open a hospital or a medical facility of various kinds are going to have to get a certificate of need. And those boards tend to be dominated by incumbent providers. A lot of you probably know about this, and it limits competition in healthcare. Also, moving companies. North Carolina is one of those states that where if you want to start a moving company, you need a certificate of public necessity, I believe it's called here. And so that limits entry. So entry and price regulations are kind of a problem in North Carolina. And in fact, we create a separate index of cronyism based on price and entry regulations because we think these are generally for the interest of incumbent providers. And both Carolinas do fairly poorly on that index of cronyism, which seems to correlate with state corruption levels and seems to correlate as well with lobbyist per legislator ratios. We don't know which way the causation goes, but there is something going on here with price and entry regulations.
That's the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to North Carolina government policies and freedom. Do any of these policies really matter? Jason Sorens says yes, he has data to back him up.
Freer states had more migration, net in-migration from other states, and less free states are seeing net out-migration. And what's interesting is we've continued to see this, and we've continued to see this in subsequent years. So we've made out-of-sample predictions that have held true, that freer states attract more people. And when we look at the individual dimensions, all of them seem to make a difference. This holds up when we control for all sorts of other things.
That's Jason Sorens discussing North Carolina's performance in the Freedom in the 50 States rankings from the Libertarian Cato Institute. Sorens delivered this assessment during the annual meeting of the group Classical Liberals in the Carolinas. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. An analysis of sales data from the North Carolina Education Lottery shows that counties with the highest lottery ticket sales per adult also tend to be the poorest and most economically distressed counties in our state. John Sanders is Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now to talk about his latest look into the lottery. John, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
You know, critics tend to say that the state lottery preys on the poor. And I know that you are not an emotion-based person. You are a researcher. So you looked at the data. Based on what you found, are the critics right?
Yeah, we've been looking at these data basically since the lottery was passed. And what we have seen consistently is that counties with high poverty rates, high unemployment, high property taxes, low personal incomes always have the highest sales per individual in the lottery.
Could it be as simple as people who are more strapped for money are maybe looking for that big win, something to help lift them out of that situation?
I think that has to be at play because it's more of a linear thing. It's not just that the poorer counties have greater sales per adult, but the lesser poor have not quite as many sales per adult, and then the wealthier counties have the fewest.
Give us a sense, if you could, of Is there a regional trend? I know you're talking about poorer counties and things like that, but are there regions in the state that you're seeing this? Is it more rural areas? Is it urban areas? Kind of give us a little bit of a profile.
In trying to look at it, I mean, it does seem to be more of an eastern thing than some of the western counties, at least for the mountain counties. The lottery officials will point out that some of this has to do with interstate. And I can see some of that coming into play. You can look at I-95, the I-95 corridor and 64, Highway 64, but that's not enough to explain these wide disparities that we keep finding.
And that's an important point. You say that we keep finding, the lottery is a couple decades old, something like that?
Yeah, almost a little over a decade, yeah.
And you've been looking at this since the very beginning. Have you noticed any changes in this at all?
No, not in terms of, we've found consistently that the poorer counties have much noticeably different, higher sales.
John, have you noticed any concerns about this type of data from policymakers over the years? Certainly there are some advocates who simply don't like the idea of gambling, or particularly a state-sponsored gambling. But are there lawmakers who are saying, you know, maybe this isn't a good idea based on what we're seeing in the sales?
You know, certainly seen some on left and right who have concerns about it, but not anything approaching a movement.
And we know also within the lottery that a component of the state lottery is an addiction hotline.
Right, right.
Which should tell you right off the bat that perhaps that's an acknowledgement up front that this could be a problem, at least for some people.
Right. We know we're kind of playing with fire, politically speaking.
Well, John, the whole adoption of the state lottery in North Carolina is kind of wrapped in controversy over how it was done, et cetera. But I know that you have written a lot about the connection between state government and gambling. Give us a sense of your view about a state operating and endorsing gambling.
Well, what we have in North Carolina is a government-blessed monopoly on gambling. You know, it's illegal unless it's done by a state lottery, which has some other implications. I mean, the lottery is pretty much the worst form of gambling you can engage in. It has
the
lowest winning percentages. I mean, if you want to talk about, well, I guess we have, you know, we have casinos also. So I was forgetting about that. But even those are on reservations for the most part. Gambling on sports, on outcomes, on sporting outcomes, card games, casinos. And there's so many different forms of gambling with better chances of winning. You know, you don't get these 1 in 10 million chances of winning. You know, your life savings for the
astronomical odds.
Yeah.
I know. On the times that I have bought lottery tickets, I never think about the fact that the likelihood of winning anything really is so incredibly low. But and some people will push back against the type of thing that you're saying and say, hey, this is just for fun. It's just entertainment. And you folks who look at the data are making too much of this. How do you respond to people who say this is just like, you know, buying a ticket for a movie?
I can get that. And if we want to have that, that's fine. And there are ways for the state to continue to make money on that if we made it off of sales taxes or some sort of tax like that without having the additional problem of a state monopoly over what many people consider a vice and what some other people think is just exploiting the poor.
It's been interesting over the years to watch the discussion and the policy decisions on gambling activities in the state. I can recall a big to-do over the issue of video poker leading some people to say, why is it okay for the state to be running a lottery, but other types of gambling are deemed illegal? Help us understand kind of the conversations about that.
Well, I think with that, they worry about it competing against the lottery.
So it's about the money.
Yes.
Interesting.
The same thing with, I guess now it's fish tables, which is another sort of market workaround the problem of gambling being outlawed.
I'm not even sure what that is.
Yeah, that's a long one to try to explain on the radio.
Okay.
But yeah, it's... the policymakers are probably going to take take those off the market as well, I think.
Is North Carolina unique or unusual in any way in terms of state endorsement and state operation of a lottery?
No. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why policymakers were inclined to get involved was because other states were doing it and we were worried about losing whatever market there could be for lottery tickets to buying over the borders.
Now, it's called the North Carolina Education Lottery. So some proceeds do go to public schools.
Yeah, that's what it's all about, supposedly. And I have argued since the beginning that that's a policy question. Money is fungible. Lottery money goes into a flow, basically, in the General Assembly. If we want to fund education, then we need to prioritize it even greater. And we've seen the General Assembly do it in the last few years where they've made a point. We want to raise teacher salaries to a certain level by 2020, and they have deliberately done so in repeating years, which means they can do it with or without lottery money.
So, John, if you had the ear of state policymakers, and hopefully some of them are listening to this program right now, what would you offer as recommendations for a path forward when it comes to the state lottery?
I think we should get rid of the state lottery and then return to an open budgeting process for education where we debate about it and talk about it in public instead of acting as if a certain portion is going to education and then everything else is up for debate.
John Sanders is the Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He writes frequently about the issue of the state lottery. You can read his latest work, Lottery Sales Still Depend on Economic Desperation. You'll find it at johnlocke.org. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.